there must have been a certain kind of eerie quality to the atmosphere when Noah and his family stepped from the huge door of the ark onto the surface of the world. Their voices must have echoed on the slopes of Ararat the way ours do when we enter a house for the first time in which there are no furnishings. They could look at the panorama before their eyes. They could scan the horizon in every direction and come back to see each other with the awareness that there were no other people in the world. That is why I say there must have been an eerie quality to the atmosphere. Just over a year before, the atmosphere of final preparations on the building of the ark and the supplying of the ark had been surrounded by the activity of the world's people of that time. Then the voices of Noah and his family could easily have been drowned out by the din of the multitude of other voices around them. But in the new world, so far removed from that old world, there were no other voices. Even the sounds of the animals who left the ark with them would quickly die away as they moved farther and farther down the slopes, farther away from the ark. It had to be a sobering hour when the quietness of a world devoid of everyone except for themselves pressed upon them. The sound of the wind at that elevation would have given them a kind of chill. Whatever life would be from then on, it would surely be dramatically different from anything they had known. To be sure, they had built the ark and entered the ark and stayed in the ark at the word of the Lord. They had left the ark at the word of the Lord. They may not have fancied themselves in the role of pioneers, but if anyone could ever qualify for that designation, Noah and his family surely could. In this country's history, in the period known as the Pioneer Period, those intrepid souls who left all that they knew behind them for the mere promise of something better, usually confronted, when they got wherever it was they were going, indescribable hardships. In nearly every case, they had to set about providing for shelter and for the pressing necessities of food and water. Usually, they did not have the luxury of deciding what the best course would be to follow. Often, all alone on the prairie, they would have to start clearing the ground and busting up the sod to build those gloomy structures that rose haltingly, it seemed, from the plains. Whatever the achievements of the life that those people had left behind, they had to set out as though none of that had ever happened. And so it was with those who took the first steps away from the great structure in which they had survived the great flood. When we see them in our mind's eye, as the words of our passage this evening describe them, we can place only one title above the entire scene. They were like the pioneers, beginning again. The sheer enormity of the task that faced them would have been enough to intimidate anyone. Where would you start? We considered last week that Noah devoted his first time and energy when he left the ark to the worship of God through the blood of the sacrifice. But after that act of worship, after the first construction project, if you will, in the new world, what would be the next great priority? And how would they cope with the animals that had traveled with them in the ark? Or with the dark legacy of the old world that they had carried with them? Surely it would not take very long at all, they must have realized, before the same sins began to surface and the same crimes began to occur. There was a lot that could have caused uncertainty and even fear. But in the words of this passage that we have read, they heard again the voice of God. And I think it's striking how at every point along this whole process, they heard the voice of God. And they knew the truth that God would never abandon them. Here's a message for you this evening. When you face changed circumstances and all of the challenges that those changes bring, you may rely on this truth. God will never abandon you. It's a word for our brother, Reverend David Brehm, who has embarked this day on his tasks as senior pastor of Faith Free Presbyterian Church in Greenville, South Carolina. With the time change, I was able to see a few minutes of him preaching this evening in the pulpit there in Greenville, and thought about all the years that I have known him and how we could never have foreseen that he would have such a responsibility as God has now placed upon him. Well, there is for him, I'm sure, a sense of beginning again, a sense that can be daunting. But God's voice is there to grant him assurance. And that same voice grants assurance to you, whatever the changes are in your own life. I want you to notice this evening the three aspects of God's word to them on this occasion that serve to settle them as they began again. Let us notice, first of all, the command for confidence. The command for confidence. Now, let us not consider Noah and his family in a vacuum. Let us remember the memories of the previous year's experience on the ark would have been very fresh in their minds. And with those memories so fresh in their minds, there must have been a certain hesitation. You could understand it, could you not? A certain hesitation to begin again to build anything. For they had seen that which had been carefully established in the old world swiftly and violently obliterated, so that when they emerged from the ark, not a trace of it remained. Should Noah's sons and their wives even consider having children? After all, they knew that their children would be born sinners. They knew that it wouldn't take very long for the pollution of wickedness again to spread over the face of the world. Wherever people would go, it would go with them. You know, there are couples in the world around us now who wonder if they should bring forth any children into the midst of all the chaos, into the midst of the perversion. It's an understandable concern. Certainly Noah and his family could have been excused for wondering about that prospect, for they had already seen the full manifestation of evil in the world that now they could only remember. They had known people who had been assaulted in various ways and even murdered. And for all that they knew, they no doubt had heard of many others. Would you want to bring forth children into a world with such a prospect? But there was the word of the Lord. There was the command of the Lord to them in verse 1. Be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth. The word replenish meaning simply to fill. Fill the earth. Fill the earth with your offspring and their offspring. Here was the word of the Lord to them. Don't let the uncertainty of the situation or the possibility of wickedness again overwhelming the world keep you from doing that which you have been called to do. And I continue to say to you, even tonight, that the only impact really that the people of God have in any lasting way on the world is through their children and their children's children. It is through those direct contacts that you affect the world after you. Ultimately, it was this command that led them to reassert, if you will, their wholehearted reliance on the truth that God was in control. That is, the fact that the world had been in such an awful state before, and the fact that there had been such a judgment, did not mean that God had lost control of His creation. They dared not reach the conclusion that the God who had brought the flood in upon the old world of the ungodly would not be able to keep control of the new world when, as it was inevitable, the ungodly would spread forth upon it. So in verse 1, and again in verse 7, and I think that is striking, we find the command, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth. What was he saying to them? He was saying, look, don't let your fears overwhelm you. Don't let your uncertainty, don't let your memories overwhelm you. Be confident. Have hope in God. We remember the Lord Jesus Christ speaking to his disciples on the night in which he was betrayed. And what did he say to them on that occasion? Let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God. Believe also in me. And literally he was saying, stop troubling your hearts. Stop stirring up your hearts. Stop letting fear come over you and dominate you. We may say that we believe in God. I trust we will say that. That's what our profession is. But is it not true that often the uncertainties of life get the best of us? And our fears dominate us. And they paralyze us. That is not God's way. May I say that again? That is not God's way. If anybody could have been excused for being overwhelmed by fear, it would have been Noah and his children and their wives. But twice in this passage, God gave these survivors of the flood this command, be fruitful and multiply. He was calling them to trust in Him, to hope in Him, to live for Him in the world that was new. Now let me tell you, this evening, as we meet here, that there is much about the world around us that would justifiably give us concern. But if we allow those concerns to dominate us, we shall cease to be lights of the world. We are called to live for God. We are called to trust in God. So there was the command for confidence. But what about the needs that they had? What did they need? They needed food. They needed clothing. They needed safety. What about those needs? Well, that brings me to the second thing that we find in this passage, and that is the provision for control. The command for confidence, the provision for control. You remember the cargo of the ark, the animals that had traveled with them on the ark. What were they doing? Well, you can be sure as soon as they got off the ark, they were away about the business of reproducing themselves. And what else were they doing? Well, they had to eat. And what do you suppose they ate? They ate the offspring of the other animals. What would stop those animals from seeing this vulnerable little band of eight people as being food to be devoured? How could Noah and his family sleep at night with the knowledge that off there, beyond whatever light they were able to kindle, those animals were lurking about, waiting for the opportunity to pounce upon them? Well, here was the answer. God said to them that He would put into the makeup of every animal the fear of people. And that is still the case to this day. The Lord said it would be more than fear. He said it would be dread. Not too long ago, I was in Atlanta visiting with the Bowmans and visiting the work of our mission there. And on the 2 days that I was there, when the weather permitted it, Mr. Bowman and I went out and visited a couple Civil War battlefields in that area. And I have an interest in that, and I had wanted to have a better understanding what took place. So we went, and one day in particular was very, very cold and raw. So we parked the car in one particular place where an engagement had occurred, and we walked down to see where the front had been of the assault. And then as we were walking back up through the woods, just the two of us, there was no one else that was foolish enough, I suppose, to be out on that day. But we were walking up, and all of a sudden I saw through the trees, I saw a deer. It was no more than 50 yards from where we were. So I said to him, I made a motion for him to stop, and we just stopped. And the deer was watching us. And then, just off to the right in our field of view, there was another one standing there watching us. And within a few moments, they decided that it would be better if they just kept moving on. So they moved away down the hillside and out of our sight. But I thought of that in connection with this particular situation. God said He would put the fear of them, of men, and the dread of them into the animals. He would create the situation in which animals would give people a wide berth And that fear, God said, would be the answer for their safety. He said, you're not going to have to be afraid of the animals. I'm going to put the fear of you into them. But the promise of God went beyond their safety. Notice in verse 2, he said that he had delivered those animals into their hands. And what was that for? It was for food. Now, there's no record of people eating animals in the old world before the flood. Perhaps they did, but there's no record of it in the scriptures. But in the New World, we read specifically that the people were to eat the animals as they had been used to eating plants before. Now, that would not be guaranteed to make Noah and his family the poster people for the ethical treatment of animals. But God is the one who told them to eat the animals. Every living thing, we read in verse 2, every living thing that moved in the world was to be food for Noah and his family. Now, there are sometimes people who like to hunt or to fish, and they are frustrated because they don't always come into the full appreciation of this statement that these have been delivered into their hands. Now, they did not need to eat everything that moved, but they were given permission to do so. Now, if they were to kill these animals, that would mean that they would have to find a use for the skins. And they could fashion clothing for themselves out of those skins. And I have no doubt that Noah and his family wore, after the flood, fur coats. And that's another thing that would put them on PETA's bad list. They could use the skins as well to insulate their dwellings. So in these two verses, in verses 2 and 3 then, there was provision for that which Noah and his family would need. God is saying, I have made provision for you. Those things that could have caused them fear, how are we going to provide for these things? God made provision to control. Here is the Lord's way. The very things that you fear, the very things that you wonder how you're going to deal with, the very things that cause you to be perplexed and to be anxious, God demonstrates His ability to control. Do you not think that this promise that God gave to Noah, following upon the heels of what we read in verse 1 and again in verse 7, that this promise alone made for much more comfortable sleeping for Noah and his family? God said, I am controlling your environment. But what about the times that would come afterward? How would the people, never mind the animals, how would the people be controlled in succeeding years? Well, God's answer to them was to establish the fundamental principle on which the structure of human government would be built. And that is the third thing that we find in this passage, the sanctity of life. The sanctity of life. I say to you again, it is the fundamental principle upon which civilization exists. The sanctity of life. Take that away and everything collapses. As the means of dealing with the violence that had sunk the old world under the waters of the flood, God demanded in this passage that there be an appropriate response to the crime of murder. He is saying in this passage, there must be respect. There must be respect for the blood of every person. And implicit in that command is that there must be respect for the blood of every person from the moment of conception when that person comes into existence. That respect for the blood of every person was to be fostered by the way in which people would behave. If they were going to eat animals, they were not going to eat them raw. They were not going to eat them with the blood still in them. Animals were to be killed and to be cooked before being eaten. Every instance of animals being eaten raw is a defiance of this command. It is, if you will, a disregard for this sanctity of life. The blood was not to be consumed. And any animal, we read, that killed a person was to be killed. You notice that? In verse 5, at the hand of every beast will I require it. So in situations where an animal, for whatever reason, attacks a person and kills that person, God is saying that animal must be killed. Now today, what happens is people go into psychoanalysis of the animal. Well, the animal felt threatened. Well, his habitat was being attacked by the evil people that were about. And so we can't really fault the animal. We need to try to understand the animal. God said, if an animal attacks and kills a person, that animal must be killed. Because the sanctity of human life is held by God to be far above the sanctity of animal life. Not many people have too much trouble with the idea of killing an animal that kills a person. You have a dog that goes mad and attacks a child and kills a child. Not many people have any doubt about what should be done. That animal must be destroyed. But when we come to the command of verse 6, people have objections. In verse 6 we read, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. That is not said of animals. So what's the process of reasoning for what God is requiring here? And this was instruction given to Noah. So this was instruction that would be passed down from Noah through his sons, grandsons, great-grandsons, and so on. So here was the fundamental principle. Somebody kills another person. That person is to be put to death. And what's the reasoning? What's the argument? Why do we do that? Because people are made in the image of God. So the command of which we read here in verse 6 in the world after the flood has its roots in the doctrine of creation. It's small wonder then that there's such an objection to this command in this time. Because many people today have been taught there is no such thing as creation. They're taught that people evolved out of the slime. But if people are made in the image of God, and they are, then to murder one of them is not just to take away the life of that person, it is to attack the Creator. Here's a person in the image of God. Somebody kills him. That is an attack on the Creator. That's the awful horror of murder. Because the murderer sets himself up as the sovereign in the universe. He rebels against the one who truly holds that sovereignty. I'm not suggesting that every murderer goes through that line of reasoning, but that is the effect. You may have read the awful story this last week of this man who took his 8-year-old daughter onto an airplane, and for simple vengeance against his wife from whom he was divorced, flew the airplane into the house of his mother-in-law, no doubt hoping to kill her as well, killing himself and the 8-year-old girl. And I say to you tonight, that was an attack upon God. That was a rebellion against God. He may have thought he was going to show his wife, whom he had divorced. But that was an attack upon God. What a shock he had, for he went to hell. And I have no doubt the little girl went into the presence of Christ. Here's the horror of murder. When a murderer strikes, and we hear so much about murder, sometimes we get a certain detachment about it. But when a murderer strikes, the life of a self-conscious and rational individual made in the image of God is snuffed out. The very image of God has been assaulted. And God views such an attack in the strongest fashion. He forbids it. Absolutely. We turn to Genesis chapter 4 a few pages back. Genesis 4 and verse 10. And he said, "What hast thou done this to Cain? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. And now art thou cursed from the earth, which hath opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand." Here is God's reaction to the first instance of murder. And I think you'll agree it is a very strong reaction. But then turn over to the famous words of the prohibition in Exodus 20. Exodus 20 and verse 13. And you can keep this portion open because we're going to come back to another text right adjacent to it. Exodus 20 and verse 13, one of the Ten Commandments, "Thou shalt not kill." It's, by the way, the sixth of the ten. Thou shalt not kill. Literally, thou shalt do no murder. And I want to emphasize that because this is a commandment that is not proscribing capital punishment or killing another person in self-defense. That is certainly legitimate. Or killing an enemy in the midst of warfare. Those are not murders. You know, you hear the anti-war crowd, and they, "Thou shalt not kill." Doesn't the Bible say, "Thou shalt not kill"? Yes, it does. Let's understand what it means. "Thou shalt do no murder." And to the anti-war crowd, I would say, that also means, "Thou shalt not murder those before they can be born." It's a funny thing how people have two standards. There is only one appropriate response to murder. And that is to take away the murderer's life. If you turn to chapter 21 in Exodus, verse 12. "He that smiteth a man," notice how this is put, "so that he die, shall surely be put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. But if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar, that he may die." There's a distinction being made here between a first degree premeditated murder and manslaughter. God is saying in the case of a man who sets out to kill, he should not be permitted refuge at the altar of God. He should be taken from there and put to death. Now there is an institution that God has appointed to carry out these punishments in human society, and that is the civil government. We look at Romans chapter 13. We find the instruction of the inspired apostle regarding the civil government. And these words were written, by the way, when the Caesars were ruling in Rome. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Now that is spoken of as the standard. Obviously, in history, that has not always been the case. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So Paul is speaking here of that which God has designed to prevail. Obviously, there are many cases where God's design is ignored. But this is what God has designed. God has set up civil governments for the purpose of restraining evil in society. And that, I say, was the fundamental principle that was communicated to Noah right after the flood. How are we going to deal with the murder that sunk the old world? God said, this is how we're dealing with it. We're going to set up government. And we're going to require of that government that it wield the sword against evildoers. And if they commit murder, they're going to have their lives taken away. So it is a power that is designed to punish. And I would have you to see that that is the foundational principle. That is, there is a punishment that fits the crime. It is an appropriate judgment. But it is also designed for deterrence. That it is designed to restrain the acts of murder in society. Imagine how awful society would be if there were no restraint at all. We couldn't even begin to imagine. The just application, notice how I put that, the just application of the death penalty will serve to rein in the violence of society. But you know, as the Lord spoke to Noah and to his family, there they were in the shadow of the ark, I can't help but believe that there is a gospel emphasis too. Because there they had sheltered in the ark from the wrath of God. And they had their minds on this truth that Christ has taken in his own body on the tree the punishment of the crimes of all his people. He paid that penalty, and he paid it in full. So here too was a word for Noah and his family. Don't forget the ark. Don't forget the way in which to deal with sin. Yes, we would like for civil government in society to function according to its design. But even then, all we can control is the outward manifestation of sin. At the end of the day, there must be, in this beginning again, a remembrance of the work of Christ. Let us draw our attention this evening, then, to what Christ has done for his people. He has paid the penalty of all their crimes. And having done so, he has secured for them the great blessing of safety, of protection, of perseverance. Noah and his family were beginning again, starting all over. There was nothing there but the ark and the altar, and they were starting over. And here was the message. There's every reason to be confident. So, go forward. Obey the command of God. The will of God is that you go out and be fruitful and multiply. So there is a word for us tonight. God's will is for us to go forward in confidence. God has called his people to be part of his army, and in these days to fight in his victory.